on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And coming up today, the Tasmanian farming couple value-adding to their historic farm after a UK visit.
There's a lot of small farms that can't justify traditional farming operations anymore, so they're about 20 or 30 years ahead of us at least in the diversification of farms.
And the Tasmanian whiskey distiller still confident about the industry despite the tough economic times.
High quality whiskies are not a need to have, they're a luxury item. So yes, it has slowed down, but that is typical of what happens in any industry, and certainly in the whiskey industry and the spirits industry. There's highs and lows, always has been, always will be.
A big new distillery in Tasmania starting to distill the whiskey, and the owner confident about the future despite the tough economic conditions at the moment. That story coming up on this Friday. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you for the Country Hour, where we also visit the historic Brickenden Estate for the farmhouse feast this lunchtime. It will make you hungry. Discussion about the cattle levy coming to a meeting in Launceston later this month as the current levy is being reviewed for the first time in 20 years. That story for you in just a moment. We'll check the latest on the weather in around about 10 minutes from now, and Richard Bailey has the rundown on the livestock markets here and on the mainland. You too can be part of the Country Hour via that text line 0438 922 936. We'll have an update on the bird flu situation as well for you shortly. First up, though, there could be big changes coming for the levy cattle producers pay when they sell their animals, and an upcoming meeting in Launceston will discuss that issue. The $5 a head levy is being currently reviewed for the first time in two decades. Cattle Australia is running in-person consultation meetings across the next fortnight. Angus Furley spoke with beef producer Harry Youngman, who sits on the Cattle Australia Levy Review Committee.
The levy was actually last reviewed back in 2006, where the rate at that time was increased overall to $5, up from $3.50 a head. And at the time, the increase was actually allocated for additional marketing purposes, and which has supported the expansion of the market access for Australia for beef globally over the past 20 years. So it's been a very positive outcome.
And what is the process now? The first review in 20 years, what does that review look like?
Well, it's very much a multi-stepped review process. And, the main question is the levy rate and distribution still fit for purpose? That's what we're trying to ascertain. And the Levy Review Committee was established really with the full support from MLA by Cattle Australia to prosecute each and every angle of the current structure and, again, determine whether it's fit for purpose. So the process to date has been, A, the formation of the committee. The committee then went out and has solicited an independent report on all the economics of the performance of the levy spend to MLA and the other entities. And we will bring the findings back to Cattle Australia, who will then put that forward as the peak body to the minister for the vote in November. So the levy payers get to vote on the findings, and that all happens in November. So all of this background work is going on feverishly in the meantime, and we're at the point now where we're going out to consult directly to the levy payers, and certainly we've got, I think, 36 regional meetings to take place over the next 3 weeks, and ours start on the 20th of July in our region.
So in November there will be a series of options for changes to the levy put to producers?
Yes, that's correct.
What sort of appetite do you think there is for a change to the levy, whether that's a change in the dollar rate, a change in the way that the levy money's spent, or maybe a change to a percentage of revenue rather than a dollar per head?
So the work and the feedback we've had so far is that there is an appetite to seriously contemplate it, and to do so, that the performance of the levy's got to be prosecuted fully, and that's actually attracting a lot of interest from growers to understand that process that we're undergoing. And so I think there's a general appetite. There's certainly a knowledge that a dollar today is worth a lot less than a dollar in 2006. And so, you know, it's that fit for purpose, both of the rate and the distribution that is attracting the interest of the levy payers.
And as you've pointed to there, $5 on an animal that could be worth, say, a couple of $1,000, that's a very low percentage if you compared it to, say, the wool industry levy. Do you think people would be willing to pay a higher levy?
Well, I think, you know, if you step back from it and say that the gross value of production, or the GVP, since that time has grown at 154%, while the grass-fed transaction levy revenue has declined in real terms since that last review period. So it does beggar the question, and I think that, you know, hopefully we'll be able to present a good economic rationale for that prosecution. So we're certainly not coming to the meeting with preconceived ideas, and that's what these series of public forums are, to garner people's thoughts and take those ideas back. So it's very much a consultative process.
And I won't go too much into the detail, but just with the breakdown of that $5 figure, most of it goes to Meat and Livestock Australia, and I think of that it's $3.66 spent on marketing and 92 cents on R&D. Could there be a change to that breakdown?
It's certainly up for consultation, and we just need to assess what the merits of that are, and you know, arguments are flying backwards and forwards on the surveys that we've done thus far. So it's hard for me to capture that right today. I think after we do these consultative meetings and we get our independent study back, that's when I'll be able to give you a firmer indication on what the sentiment is.
That was Harry Youngman, a South West Victorian cattle producer and levy review committee member, speaking with Angus Furley about the levy cattle producers pay when they sell their animals. Details of the consultation meetings are available on the Cattle Australia website, but there's a meeting set down for Launceston on Wednesday, 22nd of July, at the Grand Chancellor. To bird flu now, and free-range egg producers who want to house their birds indoors in a bid to protect them from bird flu will not be penalised for selling their eggs as free-range, Australia's consumer watchdog has confirmed. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission says chief veterinary officers in several states have issued voluntary housing recommendations where the threat of H5 bird flu entering commercial poultry flocks is analysed. ACCC Deputy Chair Mick Keogh spoke to Jane McNaughton about the changes.
The situation is that the free range standard recognises there will be exceptional circumstances arising from disease, weather, etc., where the adherence to the standard can't be maintained. So the standard basically says access to an outdoor range 8 hours a day and no more than 10,000 birds per hectare of range. So that's what dictates compliance with an ability to use free range as a label. But the exceptional circumstances provision is there. We've previously given guidance that we would consider mandatory housing orders to fit within that exceptional circumstances. Now, in this situation where the housing orders are voluntary, in other words, the state veterinary officers have said it's suggested that producers consider retaining their free-range birds in housing for the next 2 weeks. It wasn't clear, but we've now put out a statement making it very clear that if individual free-range egg or poultry producers are complying with those and voluntarily housing their birds for the next couple of weeks, then we won't take enforcement action claiming that those people have breached the free-range egg standard. They should reach that decision by themselves, and they should also consider that if this is extended, there may be value in alternative labelling information so consumers understand exactly what's going on. Because, of course, it's worth keeping in mind that consumers are paying a considerable premium because they want free range. And you should always keep consumers informed about exactly what's going on, because you want them to trust that premium is delivering the value they think it is.
How long is this advice in place for?
Well, the Commonwealth and State Emergency Animal Disease officials indicated that they would reconsider this issue on July 17th, so about 2 weeks. And we made mention of that because it is important that this is time limited. There's not an open-ended opportunity for producers to keep their birds housed and still use the free range labelling. We would consider that compliance in the next couple of weeks is in response to those veterinary voluntary recommendations and therefore wouldn't be looking to take action. But as we've demonstrated in the past, where there's blatant breaches of free-range standards, we will take action. And that reason for that is because of the consumer trust issue I spoke earlier.
And that case I believe you're talking about is the Victorian egg business, Doreen Eggs, being fined $39,600 for falsely claiming their eggs were free-range.
That's the most recent one. I think there's been three or four historically similar cases where we have taken action. So we do consider it is important, but we want to be sensible and practical in terms of the current situation. There's uncertainty what a voluntary housing order means. It's not really dealt with in our guidance or in legislation. So just to be absolutely clear, we've put out a statement clarifying what our position will be, certainly over the next couple of weeks.
And alongside the Commonwealth and State Emergency Animal Disease officials, the ACCC will be reviewing this advice on or after July 17th.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, the ACCC Deputy Chair Mick Keogh speaking there to Jane McNaughton about free-range egg producers who want to house their birds indoors in a bid to protect them from bird flu will not be penalised for selling their eggs as free-range. Now, the first case of the H5N1 strain of bird flu in an Australian seabird has been confirmed in Robe, South Australia. The Federal Minister for Agriculture, Julie Collins, has today confirmed CSIRO testing detected the strain in a greater crested tern. Two further cases from South Australia and one from WA have also been confirmed as the H5N1 strain. The total number of bird flu detections in the country is now up to 12. Now, time to check the latest on the weather. Tom Anderson joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Tom.
G'day, Tony.
Now, what's happening with the weather? It looks good out there.
Yeah, beautiful day out for most of the state. We're just seeing the last little bit of fog that was up in the Upper Derwent Valley clearing now. Otherwise, yeah, pretty beautiful day, but unfortunately, it's just about the last of it to come. So we might get some part of the way through tomorrow before it starts getting too miserable. It'll start getting worse about the northwest first, of course, as we have a cold front come through, but we'll see some windy conditions pick up. So for tomorrow, we've got marine wind warnings out for strong wind for all coastal areas, but then that'll get worse as we get into Sunday and Monday. We likely have gales for at least much of the north and west coast, but we will see, yeah, into some pretty wintry weather with some strong westerly winds and a decent amount of rainfall with that. With those westerlies, we'll see the little bit of rainfall about the northwest today and tomorrow. Not today, sorry, I should say. Might see a little sprinkling today, but it'll be tomorrow afternoon when we start seeing the rainfall come in for the northwest. And then once that front passes through, it'll be predominantly about the west, western district and the west coast for the next couple of days. Looking at some pretty hefty rainfall totals. So Strawn, we're looking at 10 to 30 mil for Sunday, Monday, and even into Tuesday, possibly up to 25 mil. So pretty wintry and wet weather coming up for Tassie.
Okay. What sort of temperatures have we got at the moment, Tom?
Looking around at the moment, we are seeing temperatures, what have we got, 10 degrees in Hobart. We're looking at 11 in Launceston, 13 in Devonport. Looking at 12 for Burnie, 12.5 for Smithton. On King Island, we've got 14. Flinders Island, we've got 13. And Strawn at the moment is also 13 degrees. On the west coast, east coast, sorry, I should say, we're looking at 13 for St. Helens and 14 degrees at Friendly Beaches.
Now, warnings, you mentioned a couple of wind warnings there. What else have we got?
So otherwise, we had the road weather warning this morning. That was for icy conditions, probably expecting that to come back tomorrow again. So it's been cancelled for today now that the sun's up, but expecting that again probably for at least the Midlands and Upper Derwent Valley. Otherwise, We are just monitoring the flooding situation at the moment. No flood watches even out at the moment, but just with the rainfall that will come and the saturated catchments we've had from a little bit of flooding about the northeast over the last week or two, we might see some river rises coming with the weather. Obviously, it depends exactly where the rainfall lands and how that affects the rivers, but at the moment we're expecting the rivers to rise a little bit, but probably not reach the minor flooding level.
And the coastal waters and swell.
Yeah, so coastal waters for tomorrow, we're looking at the northerly winds, initially 10 to 15 knots, but as that system comes closer throughout the day, we'll see those picking up to 15 to 25 knots for much of the coastal areas of the state. However, about the northwest, we might see up to 30 or 35 knots, especially a little bit further offshore. And about the northwest as well, they'll tend westerly by the evening, whereas for most of the rest of the state, we'll see those westerlies come in by Sunday. Swell, we'll see a 2 to 3 metre southwesterly for the west coast and the south coast. About the north, it'll be below 1 metre westerly swell, and for the east coast, we're seeing a southerly swell between 1 and 1.5 metres for tomorrow.
And the wave riders, no news from them yet?
No news, unfortunately.
Okay. All right, Tom, thanks for that.
All right, thank you, Tony.
Good on you. Tom Anderson from the Bureau with the latest information for you. So enjoy the current weather while you can. It's going to definitely change over the weekend. In a moment, we'll take you to an historic farm in the north of the state where they're having a farmhouse feast.
Where are you listening in this morning?
Mornings with Leon Compton.
Ian, what are you doing? Tuning into your ABC local radio across Tasmania in WA.
I keep my finger on the pulse of what's happening in my hometown.
Lovely, Ian. Good on you, mate.
Join in the conversation anytime.
Rachel, where are you listening in this morning?
I'm sitting on my lounge with my 11-week-old son.
Is the ABC a bit of company for you, Rachel? Keep you sane.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we've started listening every day.
It's nice to have you with us.
Weekday mornings from 8:30, 936 ABC Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Let's cross live to Canberra to Julie Collins.
Two further cases from South Australia and one from Western Australia have now been confirmed as H5 bird flu from the CSIRO lab testing. This brings the total detections of H5 bird flu in Australia to 12. There is one further suspected positive from Western Australia that is still with the CSIRO lab for confirmatory testing. Our scientists are undertaking further work to establish the potential pathway that resulted in the Australian seabird's infection. What we do know is that this is a coastal seabird that has an overlapping coastal range with migratory seabirds that have previously tested positive for H5. I have been briefed this morning by Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer on this development, and our experts are continuing to meet to discuss the ongoing response. While this, of course, is a concerning development, it is not unexpected and is another sign that our strong biosecurity system is working. The South Australian Government, who is leading the response on the ground in South Australia, is implementing enhanced surveillance in the area where this bird was found. This will help to establish if there have been further spread of the H5 bird flu.
That's the Agriculture Minister Julie Collins confirming a seabird with the H5N1 strain of bird flu. Well, 7 out of 10 tourists are seeking out agritourism experiences in the state, but locals are increasingly looking for the story behind their food too. At Brickenden Estate, the Archer family want the public to taste their 200-year history, hosting long table farmhouse feasts as part of the 2026 off-season campaign. Larissa Smith has the story.
Welcome, thank you for coming.
This is the first time in 200 years of farming here at Brickenden that you've been able to come here to the farm and eat their lamb on the farm. It's all about low, slow.
For decades, Brickenden Estate, Australia's only privately owned World Heritage listed convict site, has opened its doors to the public to experience its village and working farm. As owners Richard and Lou Archer transition into retirement, seventh generation farm manager Will Archer and partner Sarah Benson are making their mark. They're looking at ways to diversify the farm's income, utilising its beef and lamb, selling lamb boxes and running Sunday roast dinner events.
So Will's been managing the farm for the last 15 years, and I've been taking over more of the tourism side in the last couple of years. And so we were pretty conscious that we needed a way to put our own mark on things and bring Brickenden into the future. Lou and Richard have done an extraordinary job with the convict history here, but it's still a working farm, and that's really more our passion, and so we wanted to focus more on that side of things. We'd had a lot of really good ideas, and then when Lana came along, I sort of jumped at the opportunity to involve her in what we're doing. Lana Patiglio is the owner of Heartlands Tasmania. She'd been on my radar for a few years, as she'd been catering at Brickenden for the last 10 years or so, but we've started doing our own Brickenden Heartlands events, like our Sunday roasts, and all being sold out, which shows that the appetite is there for that kind of event.
Appetite for Brickenden lamb, is this your foray, Will?
The event space is not my forte, but producing lambs, I'm slightly better at. So it might be the dream for a lot of farmers that to put their own produce in front of other people. I've been wanting to do it for as long as I can remember, but we always struggled with the concept of doing it and being left with 30 or 40 lambs in a freezer or too much waste, and then the whole thing's for nothing and we're not making any money. Lana came along and we thought we better do this now because we thought it was a good idea. Yeah, we sell half lamb boxes and individual cuts through our farm store. It's been very pleasing to see that people actually care about where their food comes from, and I think that's happened. It's probably more since COVID than anything. People want a story. They want to know that the lamb is grown in a great environment. It's probably worked well with the whole route that Tassie tourism is going down, which is paddock to plate and agri-tourism, agri-food.
And you're involving another business, so this is where I'll bring you in, Lana. What's it been like for you to come back to Brickenden and embark on a new project?
Great. I mean, this is the dream project. It's what I've been working towards wanting to do for 10 years in the Midlands, for sure. I mean, I've been in Tasmania for 13 years and advocating for Tasmanian produce that whole time, but to be able to be working out of a kitchen where you're actually serving the lamb and the potatoes and the different things that we serve that are from this farm, that's the ultimate dream job, really, for me.
So, Sarah, was it always your intention that you would sell lamb off the back of these Sunday roasts?
There's people that want to come and have everything cooked for them, and there's the opposite spectrum as well. And then there's a beautiful niche market in the middle where people want to come, they want Lana's food, they want to take some home to cook throughout the week.
Yeah, we needed volume for a start because Sunday roasts are 80 to 100 adults. That's a fair bit of lamb. So we also needed, that was too much for even Lana to use. So we needed outlets for other cuts that weren't being roasted.
Right now I've got roast lamb that's going into roast lamb pies, different ideas like that that we're using. I mean, we're all about making the most. So I'm cooking it next week, for example. I'm cooking a heap of heat and eat meals, and we're doing a scotch broth that's going to be made with the neck chops that from the Brickenden lamb. So, you know, we're just making sure that there's no waste, that we're using every part of the animal.
Where does the veg come from?
Been using potatoes from Brickenden here, and lots of herbs that are already grown in the garden, and a bit of fruit that comes from the orchard. But we also source vegetables from some local farmers. We've got one in north of Launceston called Kuralala Farm, so they provided us with cauliflower and lots of fresh herbs, and they actually grow pasture-raised chicken as well, so we had chicken from them. I had a list on the back of the menu of about 10 local producers that we used, but we do have plans here to put in a beautiful little kitchen garden out in the courtyard here, and to be growing certainly some of the things that we use a lot of regularly, greens and all that kind of thing, and hopefully as we go forward we'll grow, have like a little market garden type situation where we can grow some of the things that we need and that customers can buy with their lamb to take home eventually. But always Tasmanian produce first, things that are in season because they taste better.
Sarah and I were lucky enough last year to travel to the UK for a couple of weeks, and that probably kicked us into gear, seeing how well they do it over there. There's a lot of small farms that can't justify traditional farming operations anymore, so they're about 20 or 30 years ahead of us at least in the diversification of farms. So that was eye-opening and really set us on a path of what we wanted to do. And yeah, it was great to bring back a lot of tips and tricks to use on our own property.
Brickenden's owner, Richard Archer, admits he's no foodie, but he's happy to see the public appreciate what's grown on the farm and helping to contribute to the upkeep of its buildings.
Obviously, a lot of the buildings are very old timber. We're finding with the, the climate that the sunlight is actually damaging a lot of our timber. We're looking at having to oil our buildings every, 2 or 3 years. Huge, big double-storey structures. We've got rising damp issues. We've got a few other issues with old buildings. So the maintenance bill is huge. I won't tell you what it is, but in the past it's been a lot of in-kind by our family. But now, of course, you can't just jump up a ladder. You've got to get a cherry picker in and all these things. So it's becoming a very expensive part of looking after, a 200-year-old farm.
So the diversification of the tourism side of things, getting into agri-food, are you reinvesting some of those profits back into the upkeep of Brickenden?
Oh, I'm afraid all the profits go back into the upkeep of Brickenden. And obviously we're very careful about trying to make sure that the buildings we have are used. We do occasionally have to restore a building just because it's old and it probably has no profitable use at all. Something, like the chapel, for example. Cookhouse and all those things which, have just still got to be restored, but they're really just an attraction on the site. So we've got to try and balance, what we can do with a building to make it return some money but also keep it in good condition. When we started back in 87, I'm not sure how many visitors were, but we were a small-scale accommodation farm attraction. Now, obviously with promotion from the government and obviously more people around, we think there's a lot of opportunities for people. Obviously the wine industry is still going pretty well, and obviously with the City of Gastronomy in Launceston, there's a group of people there really committed to agri-tourism, and I think that's a good sign.
Yeah, Richard Archer from Brickenden Estate at Longford, ending that report from Larissa Smith. Still to come on the Country Hour today, confidence in the whisky industry in the state with a new distillery now making whisky. And Richard Bailey will detail the latest on the livestock markets here and on the mainland. First up, the news headlines with Michael Della Fontana.
Thank you, Tony. The H5 strain of bird flu has been detected in an Australian seabird for the first time. Previous confirmed cases have involved migratory birds from the sub-Antarctic region. Agriculture Minister Julie Collins says CSIRO lab testing has confirmed the deadly strain in a greater crested tern found in Robe, South Australia. Authorities in Spain say the death toll from a wildfire in the southern province of Almería has risen to at least 12. Some of the victims were found in burnt vehicles. Witnesses say the blaze was caused by a fallen power line that sparked flames and spread quickly. And the opening match of this year's Men's Big Bash League cricket season will be played in the Indian city of Chennai. It'll be played in December between the Melbourne Renegades and the Perth Scorchers and marks the first time a foreign cricket league has ever played in India. More news at 1 o'clock.
Joel Reinberger for Afternoons.
How long is it since you washed your water bottle properly? What is living on the lip of the water bottle where your lips kiss it several times a day? Dee Carter, professor in microbiology.
We all have water bottles that we haven't washed for way too long. Metal's definitely the best.
Here's Tom Gleeson's thoughts.
I work at the ABC now. Everyone's got a stainless steel reusable water bottle. Gotta rehydrate.
Afternoons with Joel. Next level.
It really is.
Weekdays on 936 ABC Hobart. On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
One of the largest and newest whisky distilleries in Tasmania is now making its own paddock to bottle spirits in the Coal River Valley. I dropped by the Maguire & Co. distillery to find out more from Patrick Maguire, who's overseeing the new multi-million dollar venture.
Pretty much all the equipment is in and installed. We're still making a few changes and learning about the equipment we've got, but we're still undergoing what we call the commissioning phase of what we're doing. But the idea is that we'll be producing larger quantities of Tasmanian single malt whisky, more or less from now on. So it's been an interesting exercise being a part of all this from the concept design phase, construction phase, setting up all the equipment, and then learning about how to run this equipment. I'm a bit of a dinosaur. I've I'm used to doing it with much smaller equipment, old school way, walking around, opening and closing valves and looking at my watch to see how long I've got to do something for. We've got a system here that is automated, does all that sort of stuff for us. We still drive it. We still use our own nose and tongues to determine whether things are right or not.
That'll never be replaced.
Not by us, it won't, no.
Not by AI.
Well, yeah, who knows? But there's still that human element in what we're doing, and we're still, in the grand scheme of things, we're very small. I guess you could almost say we're still a craft business as far as producing whiskey goes.
And you mentioned that word still a couple of times, and we're actually sitting under the stills, aren't we?
Yes.
They're beautiful works of art. Tell us about the stills.
They are. Well, the stills are copper pot stills, which, you know, if you're making a single malt whiskey, that's the main bit of equipment that you need. One, our wash still has a capacity of 12,500 litres of wash in one run, and the spirit still's about 7,000 litres. They were made here in Tasmania by a company called Stillsmiths Tasmania. The parent company is Colemark, and they're at Westbury. They do an absolutely fantastic job. You know, they've built all the equipment, all the vessels you see here, the mash tun, fermenters, stills, all the equipment associated with it, they made. And I love the idea that we've got a company in Tasmania with this sort of capability.
Now, we've just had a look inside the stills, and you can see the liquid. How long will it be before it's put into the barrels, and how long will it be before it's ready to be bottled?
We've really got to wait and see how long it takes, but I would imagine, because we're using 200-litre casks or up to 300-litre casks, it'll take some time. So we'll certainly be looking at what we might be able to bottle, say, at 6 years. I'd say it'd be more than likely to be 8 to 10 years to 12 years before it's really matured properly.
You've got to have patience.
You do have to have patience, but we might find that in our environment here in the Coal Valley, where it's drier and a bit warmer than some other parts of the state, it might be a bit quicker. So it's one of those things we'll just have to wait and see.
How is the industry going as you see it? And you've been around the industry for a long, long time. Is it sort of slowing down? Is it quieting? It seems like there's a new distillery popping up, you know, every other week.
I hope everybody does know what they're doing. There's a lot of small distilleries out there that have popped up in the last few years, and I think that's a fantastic thing, because they've been set up, as far as I can see, all the people that I've met are very enthusiastic and passionate about what they're producing, and they all bring something to the party. And as far as tourism goes in this state, it won't be just wine now. It'll be wine and whiskey or gin or whatever it is. And they're all dedicated to what they're doing, and the quality is absolutely first class. I guess some of the problem with that is there's a lot has come on the market in the last few years, whether it's gin or whiskey or whatever. There's only so many consumers. But look, that'll sort itself out. But the way the economy's gone in this last year or so, money's a bit tight now. So high-quality whiskies, as they're all producing, are not a need to have. They're a luxury item. So, yes, it has slowed down. But that is typical of what happens in any industry, and certainly in the whiskey industry and the spirits industry. There's highs and lows. Always has been, always will be. So hopefully we can ride them out, and for the next high, we'll be there ready to go.
What's your biggest plan? Is it local, Australia, or is it international?
Look, for us, we set this up knowing that there's a big export market out there. When I was with Sullivan's Cove Distillery, we were very successful at attracting international markets. We were very successful in Australia after a period of time as well. But the international markets were very receptive. We got huge orders back in those days, and so did other distilleries in Tasmania. Our problem was we couldn't supply. We just didn't have enough whiskey mature enough to sell at the time.
So you could supply X amount of cases, but you couldn't necessarily supply a container.
No. And we started getting container load orders. And at first I thought, well, that's great. That's fantastic. You know, we're in.
Be careful what you wish for.
And then I quickly worked out, well, we can't actually supply that volume. That was a good thing to go through and to learn about. And now, like Sullivan's Cove and other distilleries in Tasmania, some of them have got quite good volumes and can do some of these things. So that's great. We've got past that point to an extent. This business has been set up with that in mind. So we can produce something, we think we can produce something like 350,000 litres of spirit per year. And that's running the stills 5 days a week, one run per day.
Okay.
So we have the potential with the same equipment produce well over 1 million litres a year.
Are you hearing that other bigger producers in the state are stopping production or downgrading what they're producing?
Yeah, some of them have, and that is, to me, that's, well, once again, it's an economy thing. There's less money out there to spend on these things, but also it's come along at a time where a lot of those distilleries have reached a point where they've got a lot of stock laid down, and you get to a point where there's no point in making any more if you're not going to sell that. So some of them have stopped or slowed down. But look, within a year or two, when the economy gets better, assuming it will, there's always highs and lows, I'm sure they'll be back into it. And once they get down to a certain level, regardless of what the economy's doing, they'll be producing again, I'm sure.
Distiller Pat Maguire, our guest on the Country Hour. Pat, looking at the farming sector of the operation, the barley, where is it coming from?
The majority of what we use here, it's all grown in Tasmania. The majority of what we use here is grown by various farms, particularly up the Midlands and North West and all that. But we do produce a smaller quantity of our own barley on the site here. Just this year, we produced, 145 tonne of malting quality barley from our paddocks, which was really nice.
And that goes to Devonport?
That goes to Devonport.
Okay.
Where it's malted. And at the moment, that's actually what we're distilling off right now.
And then when you're finished with the barley, what happens to it then?
Well, then our farmer who looks after the property here, he comes along with his big tractor and his big giant bucket on wheels, parks it under the grist hopper and dumps it into the bucket and takes it away and feeds the sheep or the cattle with it or ploughs it into the ground. So it's a nice closed circuit system, which I really love. It's one of the nice things about doing what we're doing on this site.
All right, Patrick, nice talking to you again. And
good
thanks
talking
for your time.
To you.
Thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
Thank you.
Yeah, whiskey distiller Patrick Maguire at his new distillery in the Cold River Valley now producing the whiskey. Well, further north in Australia, a Sunshine Coast mum is building a legacy with her non-drinking daughter, crafting gins, whiskies and liqueurs in the foothills of the Blackall Range. It may not be the business partnership you'd expect to work in theory, but 2 years down the track, Hunchy Hills Distillery is already winning awards with ingredients including rhubarb and ginger and lavender and mountain pepperberry. Jed Nichols met the dynamic duo who are having a whole lot of fun along the way.
I'm Kendall Williams. I'm daughter of
Joanna Williams.
And you're from?
Hunchy Hills Distillery.
How did you get into the distillery business?
Well, basically, big lover of whiskey. Worked for my husband and I thought this is going to drive me crazy. I need something that's creative and for me. So the distillery came about. We predominantly a whiskey distillery, but the whiskey only matures in October. So exciting times. In the meantime, we've got a sneaky whiskey liqueur so that people get to taste what our base spirit tastes like. And then we've played around with our gins and we've just introduced 3 vodkas, which we only bottled this week.
And what sort of botanicals and fruits are you adding to them?
Well, we're all about colour and we're all about flavour. We've got 3 awarded gins here. So we go from a dry gin to a semi-fruity and to a sweeter gin. So we've got a whole range. Our top seller is our lavender mountain pepperberry, which is a combination of many botanicals, but the main ones are lavender and mountain pepperberries.
That's a native, isn't it?
Yes, so from Tasmania.
So when you drink that neat, you get your lavender first, and then later you get your pepperberry, which is the main flavour. As soon as you mix that with anything, you get pepperberry first.
Our rhubarb and ginger is our new addition, and it comes with over 40 kilograms of rhubarb, and it is fast becoming our most popular gin.
Rhubarb, very old-fashioned veggie with big stalks that you use.
Yes, exactly. So we basically get rhubarb in 4 different stages in the making process, so it's quite time-consuming.
Are you growing it? Where are you getting your rhubarb from?
So now we purchase it locally because if I had to prepare all my botanicals, I'd need 40 hours a week. No time for gin making, so yeah.
So you've got apple and raspberry, you've got oriental dry, citrus dry. What is your base made from?
It's made from a grain-based ethanol, which comes from Manildra, New South Wales. Yes. So we make our whiskey from scratch. So we use 4 different barleys And then we make our whiskey from the time we start. It takes about 3 weeks from mashing it to fermenting it and then to distilling it before we put it into barrels. But our gin starts with a base product of ethanol. Yeah.
You've got a big, beautiful copper still.
That's Harry. Harry's our whiskey still. So he's named after my father-in-law, was a big whiskey lover. And then our gin still is called Lynette, which is my mother-in-law. So we've got the best of both.
Oh, that's really cool. How on earth did you decide to do this, though? I know you said you were looking for something creative, but have you had an experience? Did you just go, oh, I might try making some alcohol?
Well, at the end of the day, I just wanted something that was something I could give to my two girls, something that they could continue. My husband's got an electrical instrumentation and automation business. I know, very boring. And I just
wasn't thinking boring. I was thinking that sounds very technical.
Look, very good for my distillery because he built it all for me and he's my problem solver. But my girls don't want to do electrical instrumentation and automation, but I'm sure they're going to love working in the distillery. We've been running it for maybe just more than 2 years. It took us a while to build it. And our whiskey's been barreling in October, will be 2 years. And we've been selling our gins for just over a year. Mostly Umundi Market. We've got a permanent store there. We sell online, and now we're trying to branch into the retail.
Now, Joanna Williams, your daughter, Kendall, what do you think of Mum's venture that's now become your venture as well?
Amazingly crazy, I guess is a good way to describe it. Yeah, it's just booming in the best way possible. So, yeah, I'm a nurse who doesn't drink. And I thought, oh, yeah, I'll just move up the sunny coast and give her a hand with some markets if needed. And it turns out I'm now working 6 to 7 days a week just to help keep up with all this because, yeah, it's just the most amazing experience. Yeah, so I think nursing is now out the door and this will be my venture very, very soon.
It's a family affair at your joint.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a community. So when we make our whiskey, the spent grain goes to the local farmer and he makes silage for his cows. Everything gets used, which is good as well. Most of our product is local to Australia. Juniper berry and mountain pepperberry comes from Tasmania. Everything else comes from Gingin, which is Queensland. So all our dried botanicals. And then also just from the garden. We get people that come along with a truckload of lemons and limes that they've just taken off their tree. And I've thought, lovely, more work for me. Branches of lime leaves, lemon leaves and olive leaves.
We try to support as much local as humanly possible. All our artwork is Vanessa Persky, an amazing Sunshine Coast artist. So she makes it really easy for us with the labels.
It looks like you're having a whole lot of fun.
So much fun. I have to keep reining Mum in because she keeps wanting to make a million different flavours and I keep going, no.
Husband's given up. Yeah. He basically just goes, whatever.
That's Joanna Williams and daughter Kendall who run Hunchy Hills Distillery in the Sunshine Coast, Henland, having a lot of fun there talking to Jen Nichols. A time on a Friday afternoon to see how the livestock markets are going with our livestock reporter, Richard Bailey. How are you, Richard?
Going very well, Tony.
We won't mention the Swans last night at all.
Oh, well, they don't hand out premierships in July, you know.
true. Okay, Richard, let's look at the cattle markets. What's happening?
Just a little bit cheaper in places interstate, not drastically by any means, sort of 5 to 10 cents in places. Most of the decent trade cattle, 440 to 550 cents a kilo. Bullocks, 485 to 545. Cow market was 10 to 20 cents cheaper in a lot of markets, but still pretty good. Like most heavy cows are making 380 to 420 cents, and I think most of the big markets, the average was over 400 cents a kilo, so it's still pretty good money. Probably the highlight of the cattle market at the moment are the store sales, particularly in Victoria and southern New South Wales, where there have been some pretty good rains again, and between restockers and feedlots, they're pushing this market. Each week it seems to go up 10 or 20 cents. You know, over the last sort of week, we've had decent sales at Mortlake, Euroa, Leongatha, Wodonga. It's interesting, the Leongatha and Wodonga, a lot of their cattle went north into New South Wales, and the Mortlake cattle went the other way, went into South Australia. There have been some very good rains through that part of South Australia from sort of Adelaide out into the Riverland and down towards towards the southeast, but particularly in that area that gets very dry, and so they've got a fair bit of pressure on. And as I said, feedlots are very keen to get their share. So that's making the cattle market pretty solid right throughout. While on that note, next Thursday looks like agents will have about 1,200 cattle. If they're saying 1,200 now, it could easily be 1,300 next week. But just looking at the ads, there's some reasonable lines of cattle there. So if you're looking for store cattle, good place to go. 11 o'clock start.
Beauty. Okay. Lamb and sheep, what's happening there?
Oh, that's just tottering along pretty well. I think the processors would love to get the lamb price back a bit, but some of the heavy lambs in some markets are back a little bit, but not drastically. We've still got trade lambs. The trade lamb average in eastern Australia is over 1,200 cents, which is extraordinary when you think about it. And yet, on the other hand of that, we're at a five-year low as far as slaughter rates go for lambs. And I mean, we all knew it was a lot lower. I mean, a lot of these guys are only working one shift instead of two shifts. And certainly at the moment, some of them are only working 3 and 4 days instead of 5 days. So, but it's at a 5-year low, which is interesting. It sort of makes you wonder where we'll be going later on in the spring when we get, you know, hopefully an influx of new season's lambs. Early in the week, Bendigo, Ballarat were both dearer. Yesterday at Wagga, just sort of firmed to a little bit cheaper in places, but you still got, as I said before, trade lambs averaging over 1,200 cents, and most other British bred lambs sort of 1,100 to 1,200 cents, and even your merino lambs are sort of in that 1,050 bracket, so very, very strong. Feeders and restockers in those northern markets are starting to pull back. They're a bit worried about the age of the lambs. You know, you get to that stage where they'll cut their teeth, you know, while they've still got them on feed, so they don't want to be in that situation. So that's not as strong as it was. Just in a couple of markets up north, we saw two or three pens of new season's lambs, so we're probably another month at least away from seeing any numbers, I would think, maybe 6 weeks. But I reckon the processors will be hoping like hell that there's a good lambing percentage coming forward, and that that'll work pretty well. So all pretty good there. Mutton market, very strong. Look, you know, occasional market is quoted $10 cheaper, and there's another market quoted $10 dearer. Wagga yesterday, they quoted them $10 to $20 dearer. Quite a lot of sheep, you know, making over 1,000 cents a kilo. Crossbred ewes averaging 970 cents. So I'm pretty sure that's probably at a record high for this time of the year, for any time of the year, but particularly for this time of the year. Very small numbers of mutton right through the sale yards, and that will continue until we start to see lambs weaned off them sort of, you know, late August, September, and then we'll see a few more mutton in the market, one would think.
Okay, all humming along. Well, you have a great weekend, Richard.
Well, hang on a minute. We haven't talked about broad beans or anything like that. I had someone on Tuesday say, you haven't talked about broad beans with Briscoe yet. I said, I'll remember to ask you.
Look, they're coming through. Mine are probably, you know, just under a quarter of a metre tall at the moment.
Quarter of a metre?
Well,
That's a foot in my language.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to remember when I was a kid, it used to be feet and inches, you know, it used to be completely different. No, does my head still, in when I think about it.
It still is for me. Have a great weekend, Tony.
Yeah, you too, Richard Bailey. Back with us next Wednesday to check the latest weekly Power Runner sale. Well, finally, today it's dusty but exhilarating work. 1,400 head of cattle driven along Outback stock routes over 2 months. They've now reached their destination. The Outback Queensland Cattle Drive is a fundraiser to buy and put more beef protein in meals donated to disadvantaged Australians. Chairman Bim Struss tells Crispin Yeomans the cattle drive was a raging success.
We've had a fantastic last part of our journey, the last leg. We've had a 14 riders that head out from camp each morning. We rise at daylight. This morning wasn't quite as early because we had the state of origin. It was there's a few sad faces around the campfire this morning, but some of them aren't the best losers, unfortunately. But we had a beautiful breakfast again, bacon and eggs and porridge, and saddled up with our horses, and they head out and move this 1,400 head of cattle along the stock route, nice and quietly, gently, under the auspice of Billy Prowell, who is our boss driver.
And we're here in Blackall. What was it like to actually make it into town?
Look, it's great. It's a great feeling. You know, when you start off, 40, 45 days ago in Longreach, it seems a long, long way, and a long time. But we did it last year. We did the same thing, but we went all the way through to Roma. So we're only halfway this year, in fact, in comparison. But look, it's good to be able to get here. Horses are good. Cattle are fantastic. It's just one of those really good feelings that we've sort of made it and everyone's happy and enjoyed themselves.
What's next for the cattle that you've actually driven to Blackall today?
Well, the cattle are owned by two companies, ACC, the Lee family, and Western Grazing, owned by Pam Deemer and Matthew McDonald. We're looking after their cattle. They're not donated to us for to be given to us. We utilise them to run the event. So they'll go back into the yards, or they'll be yarded tomorrow afternoon. They'll be full and happy, and then they'll be drafted up and into the two different groups, and those two companies will truck their cattle out and take them to where they want to take them to. Presumably they'll head to feedlots in the next month, I would think.
That was Bim Struss, Chairman of the Outback Queensland Cattle Drive at Blackall, talking there to Crispian Yeomans. Don't forget ABC Rural and ABC Rural Facebook page. Plenty of stuff there, plenty of great stories to read. And you have a great weekend. We'll catch you after midday on Monday for another Country Hour.